Hey, this is Brian Cortillo, author of Pathfinder 18, Descent into Midnight, and you're listening to The Tome Show.
The Tome Show presents Second Darkness, Descent into Midnight. I'm Jeffrey Wynn, and in this series, we're taking a look at Second Darkness, the third entry in Pathfinder Adventure Path series from Paizo Publishing. In this chapter, Descent into Midnight, the action comes to a head. The heroes of Galarion must put the threat of the evil drow to rest once and for all, before the Second Darkness destroys everything they have worked for. Here to discuss it with me is this volume's author, Brian Cortijo. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you for pronouncing my name correctly.
You're welcome. That's 5 years of Spanish right there.
Well, it shows.
So you, unlike most of the other authors who worked on this adventure path, you were a freelancer. And in fact, here in the foreword, James Jacobs describes how he had to contact you at the last minute because apparently the guy who was supposed to write it had to duck out for some reason. Getting that call and being told that you had to crank out 22,000 words in 3 weeks.
Well, it was kind of harrowing. Most of the work that I've done for Paizo in the past was initially on Dragon magazine. I know we can't name the magazine anymore, but first on Dragon, and I worked with Wes Schneider quite a bit, and then I did some pickup work with him on some of the earlier Pathfinder volumes, Volume 5 and Volume 9, doing some little pieces here and there, but never something nearly this size, and so it was a little bit scary, but at the same time, it's as a freelancer to know that a company has that kind of respect for you and trust for you and your ability to get good work done quickly. You know, Pathfinder's kind of their signature line. It's a big nod, and it's a big deal. So there was a mixture of pride and fear there, and I thought I could do it, so I said yes.
Yeah, James definitely has a high praise for you. He says you swooped in like a superhero, and he was very pleased when the final product crossed his desk. Can you tell me how did you get started being a freelancer in this business?
Well, I initially started out kind of like a lot of fans. I would post on message boards and kind of give my comments, and this was back in the days of early third edition. I was fairly active on two message boards, one for Andy Collins, who still works over at Wizards of the Coast, and the other for Sean Reynolds, who's now working for Paizo. And at one point, when Sean was working on Anger of Angels for Malhevat Press, he kind of rang me up by email and asked me if I could look over his manuscript, kind of for what it's called a design review. It's kind of like development, kind of like playtesting, but it's basically just looking at a manuscript and saying, here's what works, here's what doesn't work, here's my opinion about it. And from there, Sean and I kind of developed a friendship and a working relationship, and I wound up editing a book for him called The New Argonauts. Once the New Argonauts was out, I wrote the web enhancement for that, and I kind of kept working for Sean, and Sean referred me over to The Game Mechanics, which was J.D. Weicker and Mark Schmaltz and Rich Redman and, I feel like I'm insulting somebody, Stan Brown, at that point. And I did a couple of pieces with them. One was one of their, kind of a mashup book for their Legendary Weapon series. And the other was editing Temple Quarter.
Okay.
And basically, once that work was finished with Temple Quarter, I started doing some freelancing for Dragon Magazine and developed a relationship with the Paizo guys, and that's mostly what I've been doing recently.
If you were offered a chance to work full time working on RPGs, would you rather do that, or do you prefer the freelance lifestyle?
There's positives and negatives to both. One of the things I like about my current job, I work in kind of educational administration, is that I can go home at the end of the day and not have to bring my work home. And one of the things about writing for RPGs is that your mind is kind of always in the game. Mm-hmm. You're always thinking about ways to write. And I don't know whether I'd be comfortable doing it as a full-time job. I don't know if my girlfriend would be comfortable with me doing it as a full-time job because she likes my free time too. And,
Do you think the game becomes less fun when it becomes your job?
When it becomes your full-time job, it might. As a freelancer, I don't experience any lack of enjoyment for the game. That's one of the things I like about what I currently do is when I play, I can kind of sit down and play, and it's one of the opportunities I get to not have to think about the game as a writer. I can just think about it as a player. It's one of the reasons
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I prefer to play rather than kind of be behind the screen is because I don't have to dissect the game. I can just kind of, you know, roll the dice and make the funny voices and, you know, move on with my day.
So as a freelancer and not a Paizo employee, I can ask you this. Do you prefer D&D 4th edition or Pathfinder RPG? What is your role-playing game of choice there?
To be honest, I like them both a lot. I like them for different things, though. I like 4th edition. I'm going to start with 4th edition because it's more recent, not because of preference. I like 4th edition because it's very plug-and-play. You can kind of sit down with a group of new players and just get into the game. And one of the things that I was lamenting towards the end of 3rd edition was the rules creep had kind of made it a little bit unwieldy to play. There was so much math on the table that it made it difficult to make it through the game. One of the things I'm liking about Pathfinder as a new game is that I can look at it sort of as a new edition, and it has the customization and the kind of unique ability to build a character to the way that you want it that 4th edition doesn't have anymore. So I flip back and forth. If you're asking me which I prefer to design for, now that's a different question, because I think that for 4th edition, a lot of the design space has moved to the character classes. And I think that for me as a designer, I much more prefer to design to feats and magic items and kind of smaller things to make your character different. Mm-hmm. And I think the 4th edition has kind of pushed out that kind of design in a lot of cases.
So would you say that Pathfinder RPG is a more advanced version of Dungeons & Dragons?
It's a more recent version of Dungeons & Dragons, and I'm not sure I can call it a version of Dungeons & Dragons without being sued. But I would say that it has an appeal to a player that's been around for longer. Mm-hmm. I think the 4th edition has certainly tailored itself to bringing in newer players. And for better or for worse, that's where Wizards of the Coast wants to go with the game, and they want to bring in a new generation of players, and that's...
Right.
I think that's good for the industry, but I think that those people that weren't really done with 3rd edition will find a very good home with Pathfinder for a really long time.
I hope so too. Now let's get into this adventure that you wrote, because this is sort of the meat of our discussion here. Now you have written the final chapter of The Second Darkness, and without giving too much away. What is this chapter like? Is it just one big slugfest from beginning to end, or what's going on here?
Actually, it's not. One of the things that I wanted to avoid and the outline had called for was to not make this a pure combat, you know, go to location A, fight, go to location B, fight kind of adventure. When you get into high levels and you're dealing with a story that's as invested as this one was, because there was a bit of an emotional pull in some of the earlier chapters, or at least they were trying to make one. Some players experienced it, others didn't. You know, mileage varies for that kind of stuff, especially when you're dealing with drow. Paizo and I myself didn't really want to make this simply a go and kill the bad guy kind of adventure. And so it's kind of far more involved than that. There's basically, what the big evil thing that's going to happen at the end has to be averted, and in order to do that, the players have to figure out this sort of massive puzzle over the land of the Black Blood, which is a section of the Darklands in Galarian.
Okay.
And while of course there's combat in order to destroy the guardians of these various pieces to the puzzle, essentially, there's quite a bit of thinking involved. Yeah, you can slug your way through it, you know, kind of like any video game RPG, but it's a lot more rewarding and certainly easier to get through if you use the tools at your disposal as a player and as a character, you know, your magical divinations and just sort of your common sense and your skills. We made a big effort to use character skills in this adventure.
Okay. Sort of like a skill challenge, you're saying?
No. I mean, yeah. It might be a skill challenge, but I was a playtester on 4th edition, so I wanted to make sure that while there was a place for skills in this adventure, I also didn't want to make it a copy of what 4th edition is doing with skills.
Sure, of course.
There are, you know, things that I think each edition can borrow from the other, but I think also that the people playing through Pathfinder Adventures aren't trying to play 4th edition,
right.
At least not directly. If they were, they'd be buying something else, and I don't want to kind of play to what they're asking for, not ram another edition down their throats.
But does this adventure end with a big climactic battle? Is that something that players have to look forward to?
Oh, of course. Of course it does. There is a big climactic battle at the end. There is gloom and doom and possible destruction. There is, of course, a poignant villain. Who that is, I'm not going to mention exactly, because while certainly the earlier chapters will tell you who that is, I don't want to spoil the story.
Sure.
For those people coming directly into Descent to Midnight, one of the things I found
is it quite possibly the lady on the cover of the book.
In general, the person on the cover of the last volume is the chief NPC for the adventure path.
All right. So if you don't want to be spoiled, don't look at the cover of the book.
Yeah, buy the book and flip through it, and then you'll know who the bad guy is.
Okay. So would you have, after having written this, would you have any advice to GMs who are trying to bring their campaigns to a close with style and panache?
I do. I have a couple. And one of the things that I enjoyed about doing this is that I had the opportunity to kind of close out a campaign. Although it's not my personal campaign, it is, you know, the campaign for a lot of people, and some people will play through a six-part adventure path and kind of put those characters down and move on. One of the things you want to do is give your players a sense of accomplishment, that they've actually done something at the end. But that's not really a matter of, you know, heaping, you know, gold pieces and magic items on them. You want to make them feel like their victories and their defeats matter. And so it's important, I think, to have both consequences for failure within your last chapter, whether that's a published adventure or what you're designing for your home game, but also to have kind of threads that tie themselves through to what goes after. A lot of players and gaming groups will continue in the same gaming world even if they kind of graduate from a campaign. They won't reset the timeline, essentially. One of the things that the Pathfinder Adventure Path does is it, you know, you kind of go through these six adventures. You go from level 1 to level 16 or 17 or 18, and then you kind of jump somewhere else. And while that's great for players that want this kind of episodic adventures, I think it falls in the end on the GM to make it feel like that doesn't disappear.
Cool.
And so one of the things we did was we wanted to make the consequences for victory and for failure in the adventure make sense. So there's one of the things we threw in there was what's called a doomsday clock, which is basically the PCs can fail here.
Okay.
And the degree to which they fail, the degree to which they really screw up, really affects the face of Galarian. We worked a little hard on that to try and make it make sense to people and make those choices that they make consequential. One second. Sorry about that, getting over a sinus infection. But the other thing is that it falls on the DM as players progress, as they move from party to party, as they move from adventure to adventure,
right,
to make it feel like their characters are part of the world and matter. And so one of the things I appreciate about the new kind of take on the adventure paths well, I know that there's been some uproar about this on the Paizo boards, is the introduction of these set piece adventures and kind of the shortening of the adventures themselves in the adventure path. The reason that I like this is because it makes room for the GM to insert other stories. It makes room for them to kind of build the characters into the world and sort of and build stories that they can continue on after the end of the sixth chapter in the adventure path. While I and Paizo and, you know, the people selling these books want you to go and buy the next one and continue on with a new party, people like to pick up their old players, their old characters. They like to, you know, continue on to 18th, 19th, 20th level and beyond that. And the adventure paths don't always give you the opportunity to do that. And so I wanted to make it so that there was a next chapter, or at least a potential one, at the end of this adventure. And the degree to which we succeeded at that is really going to be up to individual GMs and players. But we hope we did that.
Did you write this issue's set piece Infestation? I don't see an author listed.
I did not. I don't know her actual name. I know what she's called elsewhere, so I'm going to check on her
Elizabeth
real name.
Quartz.
Elizabeth Quartz wrote that. She is known as Lilith elsewhere.
Oh, okay.
She did write that, and I appreciated the fact that it really does tie into the adventure without kind of taking away from it. But one of the reasons I like the set pieces is that they don't necessarily have to be used where they are. You can pick up a set piece and use it in a regular, you know, your regular ongoing campaign, which is a great thing for Pathfinder subscribers that aren't really into, you know, 6 months of drow, for example. Or you can swap them out. You know, you can bump the level and use it later on. You can lower the level and use it earlier. You can play with that. And I think that it's always important to give gaming groups the freedom to play with what's on the table and not make them feel like if they alter what's on the page, they're going to miss something.
Just as a matter of personal interest, I'm glancing at a page in Infestation which lists some Kamazotz, Master of Black Wings and Lord of Stolen Blood. I'm assuming he's a bat god. That was the name of a bat deity in Greyhawk, if I'm not mistaken.
Greyhawk is not actually my Dungeons and Dragons campaign of expertise. If you ask anybody, it would be Forgotten Realms, but so Kamazotz is not something I'm familiar with. My guess is, knowing the guys at Paizo, particularly James Jacobs and Eric Mona, if Kamazotz is being used here, in addition to having appeared in Greyhawk, then Kamazotz is actually part of real-world mythology and has been adapted to the world of Galarian.
It's also the name of the planet that they went to in A Wrinkle in Time at the end.
Once again, I'm not all that surprised. I'll have to mention that to James. I'm not sure whether that was inserted by Elizabeth or by the folks in-house at Paizo. But
I mean, it's an obscure enough name that I'm sure it's not under any kind of copyright.
Oh, I'm certain that it's not. But that's one of the things I love about working with these guys, is that they'll throw a name on a god or a city or just a monster, and it'll trigger something in you know, the reptilian part of your brain to say, wow, I remember that from, you know, 1984 when, you know, I was a kid reading this book, and that was really cool. And you know, I like that kind of lineage and history to stuff. I like that Paizo's keeping that around.
So, commenting on the other parts of the book, the other parts of the book almost seem to not be worth talking about in comparison to the major epic adventure that fills the first half of this book. Can we talk a bit about the Land of the Black Blood?
Land of Black Blood was written by Wolf Bauer, who I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of before.
I believe he's been a guest on the show.
Oh, well, I'll have to catch up with some of your episodes. I think I'm a bit behind. It was actually a primary source for me writing this adventure, because it kind of jumps around all the way around the Land of the Black Blood. And it was, I think it's a great way for people to kind of get a feel of where you are in the world when it comes to this. A lot of times adventurers don't have the time or the space to really talk about the setting and really what's going on when the PCs aren't there.
Well, this is a region within the Underdark, or the Darklands, as you're calling them.
Yes, this is within the Darklands. I forget which level of the Darklands it's supposed to be on, because it's been a while since I've read through this.
I have no idea.
And again, you know, it was a bit rushed, but the usefulness of a piece like this is it allows you to use the Land of the Black Blood even if you're not playing through this adventure right then.
This is interesting to me because I've never really had many adventures in the Underdark before. How do you make one subterranean nightmare cavern full of monsters different from another subterranean nightmare cavern full of monsters?
It's difficult. Really, it's a matter of what you put where and who your antagonists are. The adventure kind of takes up a lot of who the bad guys are within the Land of the Black Blood. And some of the primary locations are kind of infested currently. But one of the things you do is you create new monsters. Wolf created something called the Charta for this, which are kind of these creepy fish people.
And they are in the monster section in the back.
They are, and they also make an appearance.
Fish people. They look like four-armed reptilian people.
Let me pull up the image.
Well,
they are
aquatic, but they don't look like fish.
Well, they were in the initial turnover. I saw his art order, and his reference art, and they were kind of fishy there. But they are. Aquatic. If they are in some ways a bigger, badder version of the Aboleth's scum from previous editions.
Oh, okay.
If you want to think of them that way, in terms of the niche that they fill within the ecology, but they're a lot more vicious and they're certainly more dangerous. One of the things I like about them is that they're very iconic to this region. So if you want to talk about how you make one, you know, empty cavern that's dark all the time different from another, first of all, you put a new monster in it, and you make it built into the unique kind of landscape of what you're building.
Okay, very cool. So I mean, this brings us to an end of Paizo's third Pathfinder adventure path, and I mean, I just want to thank everyone, you know, all of the authors who have taken time to be on the show, including Brian, who is here with me now. Brian, do you know what Paizo's working on for the next adventure path?
Well, Legacy of Fire is, I believe, the one that's coming out next. And that one's going to be starting out, if I'm remembering correctly, because I wasn't really involved with Legacy of Fire, in Katapesh, which is the sort of Egypt of the setting.
Okay.
And I think that's
Assyrian. I think
I'm sorry, you're right. It is the Assyrian is the Egypt, but there is a bit of Egypt in Katapesh too.
Katapesh is more India, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, mileage varies on how you plug a real world kind of analog. One of the things I like about Pathfinder in general is that, on the one hand, you can really say, "Wow, this evokes this ancient culture," but on the other hand, that's really just the surface. That's the way that people kind of relate to it. And when you get past that first level, there's really a lot of depth, and I think they're building a really deep and involved world here, which is really cool.
Yeah, I always look forward to finding out more about Galarion.
Oh, yeah, so do I. I mean, one of the things that's fun about writing for these guys is that you get to find out by designing it, by deciding.
And I think the fifth adventure path, the one that comes after Legacy of Fire, is going to be the first one to use the Pathfinder RPG system. Is that true?
That's correct. And the next one after Legacy of Fire is Council of Thieves, and that is going to be set in Chelyax.
Awesome.
And James let it slip last week, so I can reveal this now. He let it slip at the Paizo chat last Tuesday that I'm going to be working on the last installment of that one as well.
Oh, okay.
But it's so
you will be an expert on climactic.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Yeah,
I certainly hope so. I mean, I hope they call me something good and not, you know, campaign killer or game breaker or group ender or whatever. Because that's certainly not what I want to be.
No, of course not. Hopefully you'll be remembered for awesome campaign ending scenarios that everyone remembers for years and years to come.
Well, that's the plan, but hopefully not in the Gygaxian way.
No.
Gary is legendary for ending things with a bang and a whimper. I experienced a very Gygaxian ending at True Dungeon last Gen Con, so.
Yeah, too bad we lost him. He couldn't have been on the Tome Show. It's sad.
It is sad, but I think it's important for us to remember that we're doing what he loved, and we're continuing what he created. I mean, none of us can really deny that he's the father of what we're doing, both as gamers and as designers. And I know that I and the guys at Paizo and a lot of my friends who, you know, work in the industry owe him an incredible debt, because otherwise we'd be still sending in scripts to Marvel and DC and being rejected.
So go out there and loot and pillage and level up.
Yes. Kill the bad guys and take their stuff.
All right. Thank you for being on the show, Brian, and we hope to have you again in 2010 whenever Council of Thieves is out.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
To purchase Descent into Midnight and check out Paizo's full range of Pathfinder products, you can visit Paizo Publishing webpage at paizo.com. Also, be sure to check out the Tome Show's own webpage, thetomeshow.com. Here you can listen to past shows, join a discussion in our forums, and even shop in the Amazon store for all the great D&D products you've been looking for. Thanks for joining me for this 6-part series. It's really been exciting talking to all these wonderful authors who worked on this one project, and I hope you had fun listening. I'm Jeffrey Wynn, and thanks once again for listening to The Tome Show Presents.